Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part two of episode 41, where we are discussing Gareth Morgan's Images of Organization. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We've been discussing Gareth Morgan's Images of Organizations and the use of metaphor to understand the organizational analysis and management. And in episode one, we gave an overview of the book and the main ideas. And now we're going to go a little further into the reading and give some different perspective to what we think the strengths and weaknesses are of this approach.
Yeah, and so what I'd like to do is to kind of start out by proposing a little bit of a framework, because in part one, we spend quite a bit of time talking about or comparing the metaphors. Some of the older ones obviously are much more developed, much more in use, much better understood. But when it comes to the newer ones, we were saying that there's some truth there, but are they really the best way to describe or to put into metaphor the different types of literature streams that they're representing? So I thought I'd offer a framework which simply takes three elements: the organization, the member, and the environment. How does the metaphor explain why the organization exists? What is the relationship between the organization and its members? And when I say members, I'm including leaders there too. I'm not differentiating leaders and members in this framework, because in a lot of ways, of course, leaders are just they're members. And in some organizations, leaders are a special case of member. In other organizations, leaders and members are like indistinguishable. And then, of course, the environment, in terms of how does the does the metaphor explain the creation and the sustainment of the boundary between the organization and the environment, or say the linkages between individual members and the environment? It's very clear that as I said in part one, the first four metaphors are very clean. And in a lot of ways, what they've done is they've answered all of those questions. They've defined the organization's boundary, defined the boundary between the organization and the environment, and set the stage for explaining both the role that members have in organization and the autonomy or the agency that individual members have. The machine metaphor clearly weighs heavily in terms of the relationship between the organization and all of its members. All of its members are a piece of the organization, and those pieces have to fit together to make a substantive whole. And the boundary with the environment is very clear. Similar fashion with the organism. There's the biological metaphor is that an organism has either a surface or a membrane or something, depending on how complex the organism is. And the members are therefore parts of the organism, which have to interact. The further down you go, the less you see all of those parts explained, especially when it comes to, say, the psychic prisons and the organizations as domination. You see a lot of discussion about, say, the relationship between the member and the organization, the commitment that the member has to the organization and the commitment that the organization has to the member, and not all of it good, but it's basically an attempt to explain those interactions. But I don't see all of those aspects of why organization, why members, boundary with the environment, interactions among those pieces in the later metaphors. And that's where I think when we start talking about, where some of these metaphors might, what don't they explain or what can shore up those metaphors, those are some of the things I was thinking about. That's what I would look for.
Well, yeah, those latter four are focusing primarily on the members, right, and how they're related to each other. And that's an interesting point, because now that you say it, I think it's obvious now that you say it, but it wasn't obvious when I was reading it. And that may be one of the reasons why I found it a little distressing, not that he did it badly, but all those other parts are left out, right? So it's this very deep internal look at the organization, in some ways like the machine metaphor, because the environment and the actual organization are a bit off out of the space that he's looking at. So I don't know if it's good or bad, but I think it is a limitation of that way of looking at organizations.
I had the same kind of impression, and I think I have in my notes written something like that the metaphor, some of them, it's unclear whether it is about looking in a different way to the same things or looking at different things. And many times, as you know, Tom so well said, it's almost like some metaphors are looking at specific aspects of organizations and others at different aspects. It's not necessarily that they are looking at the same aspects through different lenses, which is kind of the overall project seems to ideally be doing. You could have that framework as an appendix in the book for a new edition, Tom.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. And I think that's important to me because one of the things that, you know, I study bureaucracy, and I think one of my theoretical research flags is to be more attentive to the way bureaucracy is still relevant and overall formal organization is relevant even today, day and age, and knowledge economies. And that's exactly the point that I feel that some of those metaphors, not only the ones that are more critical like the psychic prisons, but even the one about culture or organisms, kind of don't realize that structure and formalization can be done in so many different ways and it can have so many different implications. So it's not that it stops being relevant. You know, it's only relevant if you're looking at organizational centered perspective, but it takes different forms and shapes and enactments and have different consequences.
You know, I didn't think about that till you just said it, but it seems very important because if you talk about bureaucracy as this hierarchical, you know, pyramid structure, top down, all these job descriptions, that's one way of looking at organizing. And then when you were talking about that, Pedro, I was thinking, oh yeah, there's also like matrix organizations and these flatter organizations. And so bureaucracy, I mean, that's one implementation of that kind of structure. And I think in the prior episode, we were talking about the importance of some form of structure. I mean, people do need some way to get their bearings in organization. And one of the ways they do it in the military, when you come in the U.S. military, they're very particular about learning the chain of command, you know, all the way from the president down to you, like who are the people in charge and what do they do? So that's very many layers in that chain of command. And then later, you know, I get in organizations, I'd see these matrix things going on, and people would have differing or conflicting loyalties to their parent organization. You could see some of that going on. So yeah, there was power this and power that going on. But I do think the book tends to maybe not oversimplify, but just not go into that level of detail, which I think is important to understand. Because Pedro, I thought you said something really important, that the structure that you use drives a lot of other things. So it's not just like, oh, I have control and there's this pyramid. No, if you change the way it's structured, you have a lot of influence on then other factors in a sort of a cascading effect. I thought that was a really good point you made.
Some of the later metaphors, though, I think are very relevant for helping us to think about new forms of organizing, which don't fit very neatly into the idea of, oh, there is the organization and there are its members.
Yes.
It's getting harder to define that. So that notion of an organization having clear boundaries and it is in this particular industry and we can identify that industry, that's not so much the case now. You've got businesses that cross different industries and are constantly changing. I mean, something like Netflix has changed very much where it fits over time and the way that it organizes. And so that's where I think a metaphor like flux and transformation, which draws on ideas of complexity and chaos theory, become really important actually for understanding new organizational forms. If you've got thousands of people across the world all collaborating on a problem through crowdsourcing, for example, to understand some of those forms of organizing, then thinking about flux and transformation becomes really important. Change becomes the norm rather than the exception. And that's where I think a lot of organizational research is going. So we have this very strong stream of research in process studies, looking at paradox and dialectics. And that's because it's such a feature of organizational life today. So I actually thought that the further along in the book we went, the more tools I was finding for looking at the kinds of new organizational forms that I'm interested in.
That's a really important insight, because I didn't see it that way initially, but now I see, oh, she's really right about that, because now maybe instead of going over all these different forms of organizational structure, it's more important to talk about the flux and these change dynamics and what are going on to help you see how those other kinds of forms of organization have a tendency to work. I didn't think about that till you just said it, but now I see, oh yeah, that really does help.
Can I play a bit devil's advocate, as I usually do? So, of course, I overall agree on Ella's argument. It's just that I think what's important is not to forget that formalization and structure in a broader sense of terms, maybe not, you know, what we think as old school bureaucratic structure, but standardization and rules or any sense of hierarchy might still play a part in gig economy and Netflix and kind of new forms of organization. I think that's what makes it the story interesting, is exactly trying to take a sensibility like this attention to flux and transformation, but maintaining an attention to things like how does Deliveroo or small startup deal with structure and deal with formalization in different ways that might suit their needs according to what is required in this new industry. So it's the intermesh that I think it's interesting to discover.
But then in the intermesh, we shouldn't forget the domination metaphor, which I think can also be relevant in some of the gig economy examples.
Right. So, you know, yeah, one of the things I was thinking about, Pedro, when you were saying that was in the, so if you look at, for example, chaos theory and how it applies to management. So I think you had a really important insight there, is that it's not everything is chaos, right? So maybe the way you start projects and bring new ideas and stuff, there's a, you know, that's a bit chaotic and people are moving from one attractor to the next. I love that metaphor. But some things, you know, I don't think, it goes back to the statement you made in episode one about the allure or importance, right, of simplicity of some stuff. You don't want everything to be chaotic, right? So if someone's requesting some time off, or they have to care for a sick parent, or something, or they need to request resources, you probably can't make an organization function very well above a very small level, unless you do have some structure and a little bit of bureaucracy built in, because you got to save the cognitive, you know, imaginative stuff for things that are important to producing outputs, not things you do all the time, like, you know, requesting to go take a vacation day or some time off to go to the doctor or something like that. So I do think I've always thought that in chaos theory, I'm not saying that there's a couple different strands of chaos theory, but I've always thought that's something that needs to be emphasized more, is that there are places where you don't want it to be chaotic. It's actually probably not helping you if people had to go figure out some complicated process for where to park their car every day.
It's so great that you had the example of taking time off. So a quick note, Catherine Turco has recently published a book called The Conversational Firm, Rethinking Bureaucracy in the Age of Social Media, in which she did this year-long ethnography in a kind of a typical new industry. I think they are in digital marketing or something related to that. Company in northeast of the US, and it's very much this kind of holacracy, kind of more millennial workforce, kind of, you know, trying new things. And the overall goal of the founders is to have the organization much more, let's say, organic, let's say free-flowing, autocracy kind of thing. And what is interesting is that at certain points they have some problems and there is some need for structure. And the employees talk exactly about that. They need some clarity of when they can take the vacation, because thus far there was no procedure or norm for how to request days off. And people are just, in principle, allowed to just communicate when they wanted to take vacations. But then things, of course, start to don't go according to plan, and some need for structure comes up. So we have like a real life example of what you're hinting at.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good example.
Yeah. I think that it also kind of raises for me one of the problems that I had with that whole metaphor of flux and transformation, what told me that it was not sufficiently mature or perhaps not wholly developed. And that's because it's in its present form, it's being applied to a subset of possible types of organization. And I'm not seeing how it really explains some of the, or basically answers better, for example, those organizations in which the machine metaphor seems to fit. So like, for example, I could take, I can probably take, given a little bit of time, any organization in the gig economy, because, you know, like with the ones we've discussed in previous episodes, and say how I can use the machine metaphor in it. I can probably use the organismic, the brain, all of those other metaphors, but I can't go the other way. The flux, and that's why I think I was trying to think of what's missing in the flux and transformation metaphor that keeps it from being, or it basically restricts it to explaining behaviors of certain organization rather than going beyond to talk about, well, why do we organize? What should we be relationship between the organization and the environment?
That's a great point, right? This whole idea that it lacks a bit of a prescriptive element where you would say, how would you know that was going on? Or what are the ways? It's just this, here's all this stuff going on. And then it's, I think for me, it was a little hard to get my brain around. All right, so what do you do with that? I mean, because he does talk in the book about he wants to give managers more tools for actually doing things, for, you know, for making action happen. But I think that's kind of missing from the flux and change, even though I think it's important.
That's interesting, though, because I think that's almost the point. It's all of the other ones are giving you a toolkit for what to do, as if you can control the organization, your employees, the environment. Whereas this chapter is pointing out that actually things are not so easy to control. The world is emergent and we can't predict where it's going to head, and order cannot be imposed. And so the advice is that, as he says here, would-be managers have to be content with an ability to nudge and push a system in a desired direction by shaping critical parameters that can influence the course of system evolution. But you can't control it. So all of the ideas of strategy and this very top-down notion of here's where we want to get to, here's how we're going to get there, we know that in practice it doesn't always work like that. So what managers need to be comfortable with is a sense of ambiguity, of realizing they're not going to be able to control every step. Things will come up that they didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
And it's more about sitting back and being comfortable with that rather than trying to give managers the toolkit with which to dominate the environment and control it.
Yeah, that's great. And in fact, I think I was feeling the tug of the control machine metaphor there. So thanks for getting my head to swivel back this other direction. That was helpful.
I think maybe what's missing is that we don't still have a lot of empirical research on those kind of conditions, so to speak. Efforts to do more holacracy and attempts to do more self-organizing teams and, you know, the problems that they run into, like the case from Catherine Turco. But we still are, in part because I think there is still the desire, and then we go to the whole domination metaphor for maintaining control. In part, it might prove complex, but it's like a promise to be explored.
Yes. And I think it would be hard. Some of that stuff is hard to study, right? Because what level of analysis do you use? Do you use it at the individual level or the group level? And then at the group level, how do you get access to these people because they're so widely dispersed? And, you know, there has been some research done on that. But I wonder if it's some of the challenges of studying it, because it is so fluid. And if you think about it from maybe an ethnography point of view, that's a good way to capture it, because it's hard to freeze the frame and say, okay, well, what's going on here? You know, what are they trying to do? Because all these other things are going on.
We can argue the other way around, because when I saw the title of that chapter, I thought he was going to talk more about process. And he starts the chapter with the whole idea of, you know, Heraclito and the river, the classic one. So in maybe 1986, the whole sexual kind of school, people like Anne Langley, Haritsukas, you know, even Weick. Well, Weick was already, you know, publishing a lot and doing a lot of stuff, but maybe it was not cut on so much. And today we have a lot of empirical, interesting research that takes organization more as in processual lenses. And in a way, you can almost say that's very, there is a good affinity with ethnography, because it's the effort to capture not specific tasks at specific moments, but the overall direction of the organization, how people are interpreting that, how they're making sense of the ongoing changes, and how different parts might be reacting in different ways. So it's very much what an ethnographer could do and what has been done, I think, at the best.
And I agree with you. And that's, I didn't say it very well, but that's what I was trying to say, was I think ethnography is very well suited to capture some of these kinds of things, or at least describe what's going on better than some other kinds of research paradigms. I'm not saying it's superior, but maybe I didn't say it very well, because I completely agree with you. That's what I would lean towards ethnography for, looking at some of these kinds of things. Because it's one thing, like Ella said, to look at these kind of flows and the flux of what's going on, and for managers to realize, or, you know, gain some awareness that you can't manage all of this stuff, and you probably shouldn't expect to, which I think is an important insight. And then it's another to say, well, how's it working? You know, kind of what's going on without being. So I probably was wrong, probably a little over aggressive by saying, you know, prescriptive
more like, you know, descriptive is probably a good way to look at that.
That's to me the strength of practice theories as well. To me, practice theory perspectives are about seeing how things are actually happening, not what the organizational chart looks like. And there's a real sensitivity to workers and the sort of knowledge that they bring to the table. And even going back to studying factories rather than looking at managers and the foreman and what they're doing, but actually looking at workers and everyday practices and how things actually get done is much more fluid and improvisational, dealing with whatever gets thrown at them every day. And that's where I think those latter chapters have more of an affinity with that way of doing research as well.
You said the magic word work, which is actually somehow what is missing in the whole story of the book, is it's people that are really working here.
Yeah, it is very much on a higher level. At one point towards the end, he says we shouldn't lose sight of organizations being actually made up of people. And, you know, I might also say, and things and, you know, the materiality of organizations as well. But that perspective is a little bit left out. Maybe he needs another metaphor. I think we all have sort of another metaphor that we'd like to throw into play.
Yes, we do. We seem to have our favorite way. But I thought I do like that focus on things. I've been in quite a few engineering technical organizations, and there is a great focus on the things aspect, the technical thing stuff, and the people don't seem to be right up there. Every now and then, you know, when you have a problem, it's, oh, should we just look at the people some more? But it seems like it's pretty easy in those kind of organizations. I'm not criticizing the people in them directly, but it is kind of easy to say, well, here's all these technical things we have to pay attention to, and we have to manage the things, and I'm sure manufacturing is similar. And so that is one of the weaknesses of clearly of the machine metaphor, that these other perspectives are very important.
Can I go back to one thing? Because what Ella talked about practice theory, we said something about process research, but what I was surprised is that that chapter in the book doesn't talk so much about these ideas, you know, maybe because they were still not so strong, they were still not kind of emerging. So it's much more things like autopoiesis, which is much more related to systems theory. And, you know, so it's a bit like, can see how this has progressed in the past years, but was not this direction necessarily. So it was kind of, you know, interesting to see.
Yeah, I agree. I was like, I think that was probably an important starting point for a lot of the conversations we have today, but I didn't get what I was hoping for from that chapter either. I actually think that the brain metaphor gave more interesting insights into different forms of organizing and systems than the flux chapter, which surprised me.
Well, I'd like to see a lot more in what's gone on for the instruments of domination chapter, because that chapter was very, very heavily focused on the emergence of multinationals, and didn't deviate from that very much. But the ideas of organization as domination and how organizations, as he put it, use and exploit employees, There's a lot there, and I was thinking of that. It was almost the counter example of the psychic prisons, where in the psychic prison it's from the perspective of the member and feeling trapped, and now the domination is the perspective of the organization and doing the trapping. I would be interested to see that if the literature has gone on and developed that particular metaphor a little bit more. Because the way in which he wrote that particular chapter was so narrowly focused on one, you know, growing phenomenon at the time that it didn't, I don't want to say it undercut, but it's like it left me wanting to know more.
And speaking of wanting to know more, what I think it would have benefited that chapter and a couple of the others is if he'd actually gone a little bit more detail about how some of these things are being researched or had been researched, right? So there was a lot of historical development kind of looking at what the origin of the metaphor was. But when Ella was talking about that, I was thinking, yeah, it would have been interesting to see, well, what, and I recognize it would be dated. And so I don't think he would have had to rewrite the book, but it would have been, I think that kind of a section would be just as important as the strengths and weaknesses of the metaphor. Just say, well, here's some of the ways it's being researched or being looked at, because I think that would have been helpful as an organizational scholar.
Yeah, I guess the postscript does give a lot of references to literature where you can read more about these perspectives, but it doesn't really discuss how it's being researched. It's more of a bibliography that's very useful, but yeah, I agree.
A lot of extra work to go do that, and I think it wouldn't have been that hard. And I think it would have been in the book to add some more of that, because that's what I found myself thinking. And yeah, it's good that those resources are there and I can go look at them. And I was thinking particularly about process theory, because that really is an interesting line of inquiry.
So to go back to Tom's question on, you know, domination and everything, there is, similar to what's said about process theory, there has been a lot of development there as well. The whole people that do critical management scholarship, it's a very strong established field. I don't know it so much from the inside, but I know that has been taken, and that has, especially in Europe, I think, has been able to provide a different perspective on the consequences, both internally to the employees, all this sense of, you know, domination, power and politics and blah, 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 but also as organizations in the environment and the whole issue of environmentalism and nature and all these concerns that we are very pressing today. The only thing is that it's funny because you said this whole thing about the perspective of the organization or the member. I would say that kind of school, maybe because it has a root in Marxism, has this attitude that is much more starting from the system to the person. Not sorry, the person to the system. It has always structural taste. From the little I know, maybe I haven't read enough yet.
Well, when you talk about Marxism, I'm certainly not going to summarize that, but I do like the way Morgan looked at that and described some of the origins and the things that Marx wrote about. I think it's really good for anybody who has very little exposure to it, like me. And it just gave me some more things to think about. I was like, what else is going on here? And I agree that the chapter on power and domination was maybe a little too big corporation or multinational corporation centric, because that goes on at many levels. And particularly one area where I've seen it research is multinational tourism companies, where that's one of the things I was thinking about, because I'm working on a research project that has to do with tourism. And some of the research I've read discusses how the tourism industry, you know, that's the big players, they tend to drive out the smaller operators in countries, and Morgan talks about that. And then they're also almost trying to create a McDonald's-like experience, which I found very interesting in the research that I was reading, where they basically, you know, curating Bali, for example. And so, you know, they have everything's walled and they have this special beach experience. And I'm not criticizing Bali or anybody who goes there. It's just that's not the same kind of travel that other people might do. And that focus of these organizations about having standard package ways to do things and how you work with them to the local operators work with them to become included. There's quite a bit of power in there, and those relationships, I'm not saying they're dominated by power, but it's a very important consideration. In fact, when I went to Cairns, Australia, you know, very, very popular place for going to do barrier reef things, and a lot of cruise ships pull in there. And I was talking to one of the tour operators, and they said, yeah, you have to be really, really responsive, because when the tour companies and the cruise ships come in, if they call for you and you're not ready or you can't handle it, they'll just move to the next person and they won't come back to you, right? So you're not going to be able to get future business if you can't demonstrate that you can produce this experience that the people on the cruise ship enjoy, but it's also packaged in a way that fits in with what they want. I thought it started me thinking, because I just looked at the sand and the, you know, the bananas and the plantations. That's what I was seeing. And then I thought the tour operator, and I thought, oh, wow, there's this whole other dynamic that's associated with the influence of the cruise ship companies.
The McDonaldization and power dynamic of cruise ships.
Do you like that?
It reminds me, I mean, one of the people who's really taken up the baton and was actually cited by Morgan at the time of writing this book was Matt Salveson, who's really written very critically about organizations. Yes. And this sort of McDonaldization idea comes into some of his more recent work, I think. But Alverson, actually, who of course we featured on a previous podcast, interestingly, he also has a book called Metaphors We Lead By, where he explores different metaphors of leadership and gives a critical perspective on that. And that book is actually riffing off the title of very famous book called Metaphors We Live By, which Morgan was influenced by Lakoff and Johnson. So there's this whole metaphor trope in the background there. It's connected to our podcast as well.
I feel that after this episode, we should do like a little book called, I don't know, Podcast Through Metaphors or Org Theory. I don't know, something like that as well to join the club.
Oh, I love that.
Exactly.
Very nice.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 41. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Gareth Morgan's Images of Organization, here on Talking About Organizations.